Hello, welcome back to Back in My Play, and this is one of those fantastic times where I'm able to get the wonderful Mike Micah on the line to talk about all things video games, not just retro, but also in the present today with the development of iDARB that is coming out very soon. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's awesome to be back on the show. It's actually been kind of this itch I've been trying to scratch for the last few months, but it's been so crazy. There's been so much going on, what with like documentaries and game production and all this other stuff. So it's really awesome to be back on.
Yeah, it's like you have a job.
I do have a job, which makes it a little bit harder to do all this.
Yeah, and let's talk about that just to start off, because before we started recording, one of the things that I was like mentioning is the first time that you came on was, I believe it was in March. So That was kind of a long time ago now. And, you know, obviously you've been working on iDARB with the team. And I was just kind of curious, like what that process has been like. And you guys are done, right? You're done with the production?
Yeah, production's all done. And now it's just in the process. And there's all kinds of things related to that, like when to release, and also there's all this like marketing and all these things that have to be all coordinated. So it's funny to be done and not be able to just say, here, everybody. Yeah. Even though it's a digital title, it seems like, oh, this would be great. Now everybody can have it. But yeah, we're done. And when we were talking in March, that was just probably after the coming out party for the game. Because even though I was tweeting about it, nobody had actually had their hands on it. And we brought it to a game developer conference on the Xbox. And I thought at the time this was just going to be like this little prototype that Microsoft's going to let us have a little corner of the room for. But it was a really bizarre experience to walk into the show and see that they put us right next to Titanfall. And we're like, here's a game that's only been in development for maybe like 3 to 4 weeks. And we're next to Titanfall on the show floor. We felt really out of place, but quickly though, like really quick, when people were coming by to play it, it just kind of, the word of mouth I think got around, and people started to gather around the game because it was this bizarre thing that I think nobody expected, let alone us, to be exciting.
Yeah, with the evolution of iDARB, it's also kind of been going along with the real turnaround at Microsoft with the Xbox, and that has been for me personally, and you know, I've talked about this on other shows, that what Microsoft has done to turn around the, you know, what people were saying about Xbox and the Xbox platform and the, you know, development and things like that for it has been amazing, and has gotten me to the point of saying, like, man, I guess I can only be with one console or two consoles this generation. I'll wait on the Xbox till it's cheaper. Till like now, for the last almost month or so, I've been playing nothing but Xbox games, and the platform has just been really kicking butt. And it's great to see that they're getting their, putting their money behind it, I guess, with the price cut. So it's got to be good to see that as a developer, to see that those consoles are flying off the shelves right now.
Oh, it is amazing, because we're looking at like the last few years being something where we're all scratching our heads going like, is this all just going to go mobile? Are consoles going to survive and that sort of thing? And then Sony and Microsoft come out and the numbers are so healthy that all that discussion just went away like almost overnight. But then, as you were saying, to see Microsoft go from like a distant number two really in the next gen launch, because Sony had played their cards so perfectly and they were like pitch perfect on every message they gave out. And Microsoft had that like kind of stumble with that first press conference where it's like, are they even going to make this a game machine and all that kind of stuff? And to see like the amount of effort they've put in and turning that around, and they've really turned it around. We're seeing numbers coming in right now that show that they're actually surpassing Sony in some markets that we weren't expecting to see until like mid next year, maybe by the end of next year. And so, I mean, a lot of credit to, you know, Phil Spencer, who took over the Xbox division, and a real passionate gamer. It's just like he's the guy who, before it was announced that he was going to take over that division, he came by where we were and hung out and played the game with us. And we, like, I didn't know he was going to be, like, by this point, he probably knew he was taking over the Xbox division. I didn't. And we're just sitting there goofing off and have this great time playing this game. And then, like, the next day or a day or two later, like, we find out now he's head of Xbox. Yeah, but he's a hardcore gamer, and like when he was sitting there playing, I just remember having such a good time. He's talking about like, what games are you playing, and what's this, what's the best of the show, and it's just like, he's a very casual guy. And then we have Chris Charla, who's been like kind of a passionate independent game developer proponent, basically. And he's been behind so many like things, like I think he was involved in like getting Minecraft and stuff like that onto the Xbox. And so you see like him basically developed that program, the idea at Xbox program that we're in, at the same time that we're kind of doing this iDARB game. It was just like all the stars were aligned. And I've been able to have this like great vantage point from not being part of Microsoft, but seeing the inner workings because of all the timing, and to see how hard they're working. It's insane. And like going to this holiday, it's just I hadn't seen such an awesome flurry of things going on, and having such a positive like result from that.
Yeah, I think if people are out there listening and thinking about jumping in, like for, I know we're talking about retro games for the most part on this show, but some of the most fun I've had playing games in the last couple of years have been on Sunset Overdrive, which I hope starts selling better, and also Forza Horizon 2. Like those were just two fantastic games, and also I got Halo coming for me and my buddy to play, who's my best friend lives. This great thing about video games, my best friend lives in Orlando, so from Massachusetts, I'm going to be playing through the four Halo games with him.
Oh yeah,
as he's waiting on his first child, so it's going to be a great timing setup, and that's why video games are great. It can bring
the Halo together, Master Chief Collection. I got that game, and like despite all the frustration, I had a lot of frustration because I put it in and I had to download 15 gigs,
yeah.
And I'm like, oh god, I just want to put in a game and play it right now. But once that kind of got all cleared up, that is the best value I think I've had in 10 years. The best value since the Orange Box, basically, probably.
Yeah.
Of games in one spot. And I remember like when I was waiting for the full game to download, I was like trying to see what I could play first. And Halo came up, and Halo 2. So I just started walking around the multiplayer maps by myself. Mm-hmm. And I started to like have flashbacks to times that where big gunfights were, epic battles that I had with my friends playing LAN over LAN and stuff. And we're joking because I was talking to Chris Charlie actually, because we used to play Blood Gulch over and over again with like 14 of our other friends. And we were kind of walking around and reminiscing in the map going like, remember when we killed Kevin here? And it's like, oh, that was so awesome. And I was like, yeah, I was on his team, but he hated it. But that made me want to do it more. And I was like trying to get him not to get so frustrated to leave. And so we were like ended up probably spending the next 30 minutes reminiscing about the times we shot Kevin and the joy we had in doing that. Even if we're on his team.
Oh, yeah. And it was that was a magical game. And it's amazing to think that it's 13 years old, the original Halo now. But with that was my first like access to online gaming on the Xbox was the original Halo through tunneling software through like GameSpy.
Oh, yeah.
Like trying to fake the networking of the original Xbox to make it think that you're just connected to other Xboxes in a room. But yeah, that like you said, for four games, like four of the best games of the last 11, 14 years on one disc. And it's just it's an amazing collection. They have a hell of a holiday lineup. They just really kicked ass this year. So yeah, $349. Go pick one up. It's worth grabbing. On that, I mean, we'll get back to iDARB in a second, but I'm curious because the last time that you were on, we talked a little bit about the preservation of games and, you know, the importance of making sure that in 20, 30 years from now that we're going to still be able to play this stuff in the optimal conditions. And one of the things with the current generation is that you're seeing a lot of stuff that is launching with issues, like whether it be online or with, I guess, playing through Assassin's Creed Unity and that having quite a bit of issues. So I don't know, just as a developer, what are your thoughts on like this generation? Because you got to think that in 15, 20, 30 years, Xbox Live might still be there, but the original updates for these games might not be. So are there any concerns in the Game Preservation Society of, you know, making sure that we save these updates, or how do we do that?
That's the challenge, right? Because we're seeing day one updates. We're seeing patches almost every week. And sometimes even more than that. And, you know, later on when these services go down, I mean, it's getting worse since last we talked, because Assassin's Creed is probably going to go through a series of updates, and it's really hard to tell which ones break what. And somebody's going to have to keep track of not only that last version, but for historical reasons, I think we need to keep track of all those iterations as well, because they do have impact. You can trace like the you could probably trace the sales effect of Assassin's Creed Unity and kind of the bad rap it got at launch. And if they can turn this around with updates and trace like what could happen with that, if they can get sales back up and stuff, it all has this historical implication years from now to be able to look back on and see those versions and actually get your hands on those versions and see what, if, like, is with 20 years behind it, mm-hmm. did that really cause Ubisoft to have financial difficulties in 2015 or mm-hmm. these sorts of things? So the hard part then is, how do you get this stuff when it's on such a diverse platform? The Xbox One, you can't just take the game off and, you know, back it up and load it up later and that sort of thing. So we still have not come to a place where we can work with Microsoft or Sony and have a way to load these up later. I've been talking about this a lot with Frank Cifaldi here in the office, mm-hmm. and we've talked to a lot of people, like our friends at Microsoft and Sony, and everybody's willing to do something, but until it comes time to write a check to sure. just put the effort in.
Yeah, and Frank would be the guy to be, you know,
he would be
on the front of that. It's good to know that at least people are thinking about it. Because it's not just, you know, I'm not as concerned about the Assassin's Creed games that are going to sell millions of copies. Like, I'm more concerned about the game that sells 100,000 copies, but maybe in 20 years, people look back and be like, oh man, this game was, you know, doing these crazy things with the mechanics that these later games iterated on. I want to go back and see what that first iteration was like. You know, like we can do with, you know, so many Genesis games, Super Nintendo games, just a cart. You just plop it on. It is what it is.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, we did War of the Worlds, which mm-hmm. it reviewed kind of crappy. And we sold, I don't remember how many we sold. It wasn't that much. It was like, we probably just barely broke 10,000 on the 360 or something. And we didn't get a chance to update it and do any of that sort of thing. And then they delisted it, and we really... Even now, I don't even know if we have a copy we can try to execute and run.
Oh, wow.
And here, coming from the guys who, you know, are sitting there telling everybody, you need to do this, like, I don't even know if we can do it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of frustrating because we've been talking about this internally. What can we do? Like, we have the source. Is there a way that we now spend time getting it to run on something else? Well, it's not going to be exactly on the 360 the way the 360 worked. At least getting it on PC, even if we don't even release it, but getting it playable is going to be important. And we're working with the Library of Congress, Dave Gibson over there, who's mm-hmm. a phenomenal guy. He's like this lone wolf with Brian Taves and the crew there, trying to get people to understand that the Library of Congress will do the work for you. So in the case of War of the Worlds and in the case with iDARB, we are going to be giving them the complete source trees and everything and get them into the Library of Congress, where they will hold those copies and maintain them forever mm-hmm. and also make sure that any tools or anything else that can come into play to help get these games playable in the future are being coordinated and developed. So these are the same kind of people who are preserving old recordings from some of the greatest musicians of all time throughout history, or finding the print of Frankenstein that we can master a 4K version from. So all these same people are going to be doing this with software now and games. And so I think it's really important that we get the word out that at minimum, send out what you have to the Library of Congress mm-hmm. and they will take care of it.
Yeah, that sounds like a damn good plan. And for people, we actually got questions to the show a couple months ago about, like, what do you do about 360 games or PS3 games today? Like, I just been saying, like, grab the Game of the Year edition whenever you can. Get that Game yeah. of the Year edition with, like, all the updates, or at least most of the updates already in there. So hopefully they've fixed a lot of the stuff since.
I've done that. I've purchased a game online, a digital mm-hmm. version. And then when the Game of the Year edition comes out on disc, I just buy the disc, too. Yeah. I've double dipped. But I want to know that, like, when that service goes down, I can put this disc back in and play it.
Yeah, like, I just did it for Fallout and Oblivion. Like,
yeah.
I want to be able to go back into those worlds in 20 years. And hopefully my 360 is still functioning. But so yeah, let's take a step back and talk a little bit more about the evolution of iDARB, because last time we talked, I remember it was right after E3, because we mentioned, of course, you being a big Halo fan, you mentioned that on the E3 the video that was going on there during their presser. So you guys seem to have gotten a lot of feedback from the people that saw the game at E3. And the crazy thing about your game is that you basically say, what do you want in the game? And we'll try to do it. Or at least we'll see if we can implement it, see if it makes sense within the confines of the game. So, you know, since then, what the hell is the game? Because it has changed so much since even just before E3, from the last videos that I've seen you posting online and from, you know, the Microsoft has been showing the game off in some spots. But what if someone just came up to you and said, what is iDARB? What is it?
So iDARB, okay, what is it right now? the game we're shipping, we're actually really happy with it. It's kind of, you know, you think after working after a year, I can describe it. The best I probably heard recently is it's like Super Mario meets NBA Jam meets NHL 94 with a little bit of Bomberman thrown in. And it's still kind of that over the year. And so my son here is going to open him a Pepsi. Hold on a second. There you go. You're welcome. He doesn't want to talk, so he's writing on a sheet of paper, like, can I have this Pepsi? So that's kind of where it is right now. We just had this wrap party, and a lot of people who came to the wrap party had not played it before. And so it was kind of interesting to see, because over the years we've seen the evolution and people who've played it come back to play it and all stuff, and they've kind of evolved with it. But watching people for the first time play it and see them, like, describe it like that, that's basically what it is. You're trying to get your ball into your goal while the opposing team is trying to get their ball into your goal. Or what we always say, it's kind of like Pong. It's like avoid missing the goal, and that's the whole game. And so you and your teammates, up to seven teammates actually, if you want to do 7 versus 1, but 4 versus 4 is the way to go, 8 players. You can go online and play against other people online, or you can play local, which is probably the most fun way to play it because you get to punch the people you're playing. And it also has – here's where it gets crazy, because I'm going to describe this, but it has these things that don't seem like they make any sense. But when you sit down and play it, because it came from so many directions, from so many different people, you can create your own characters. You can create your own team logos and your own team anthem. The anthem will play like when you win a game, even when you're online, so you can make these really dumb anthems. We have a music editor in the game, the character editor and the logo editor. You unlock recipes, like food recipes from achievements, because it's a party game. Somebody had suggested it'd be great if you had like party food recipes. So you have these recipes in there, which have come from people all over the internet. So we have a recipe from Abby Heppy, who's at Respawn, who did the voice in Titanfall, and she's a community manager and stuff. In fact, when you go to the pumpkin bread thing, the thing I like is one of the little Easter eggs is when you go there, sometimes she says like prepare for pumpkin bread. We have a teriyaki chicken recipe from Caitlin Oliver, who's the world record holder on Splatterhouse.
These are real recipes. These are real recipes. Not to like make items in the game, but just like, you know, once you're done playing, you want to make some dinner.
Yeah, and they're really good recipes from like these people who put a lot of time into them. They're really good.
So, okay. So there's a lot going on in this game. So you brought up 3 or 4 fantastic games being, you know, Super Mario, NBA Jam, NHL 94, and Bomberman. So is it still up to 10 players, correct?
So it's up to 8 players. We had 10 for a little while. We're okay. Using Smart Glass to allow people to be goalies.
Oh,
but
cool.
It just wasn't working out too well. So that might come back, but we want to be able to spend more time on that. Because when this releases, I want everybody to understand this is like a first release. We plan to be updating and iterating on this with more suggestions coming from people. But it's kind of found its purpose now. So the game that we have now is kind of the focus, but everything that we get to pile on top of it is going to continue to go on. And one of those things that we want people to help us pile on with is this new mechanic we may have talked about before called hash bombing. Which, when you're playing a game, say you're streaming this game or you're just playing local, anybody who has Twitter or Twitch can interact with the live game they're watching. And it's not like every game in the world they interact with. They interact with that one game session they're watching at that moment. And they do it by tweeting to the code that's in the upper left-hand corner of the game, or Twitch chatting to where the game is streaming. And you activate things in the game. Like if you put in the hashtag flood, it will flood the level with water. And so now everybody has to play underwater. They can do hashtag snow and it starts to snow and everybody starts to freeze and that sort of thing. You can do hashtag bomb and it turns the ball into a bomb and you have about like 10 seconds to get it in a goal before it explodes and puts people in the penalty box. We have almost 100 of those in there right now and we continue to add those.
Man, so this is almost like a scribble knots of like items that can be thrown in via Twitter.
It's true. Like our hope was that people would figure these things out because we're not going to tell everybody these bombs. And we did a charity stream with Microsoft, the Extra Life charity stream. Mm-hmm. And we gave away a couple of them. We're like, here's what you guys can do. And then people just went nuts with just the 4 or 5. And once they realized they could start guessing, they just started putting every word they could think of after a hashtag. And they found a lot. And that freaked me out because I think they found about 30 of the 100 already. And
great.
I didn't expect that to happen so fast. That was in the span of 5 hours. So I think we need to add a lot more of these things and be a little more secretive with them or use different kinds of words.
Okay. So I'm trying to envision this. how crazy this is going to be for something like when Giant Bomb does a live stream, or like there's a big, you know, a big Twitch streamer, like there could be, say, like 2,000 or 3,000 people watching a stream. How crazy does this get?
It gets really crazy. We didn't limit what could happen. Like, they could just make this thing almost unplayable. But luckily, you can still play, and you could turn it off if you don't want to do that and that sort of thing. But mm-hmm. we were on the Twitch main channel to kind of reveal the game at E3, and they had something like 15,000 people on at the time. And so we got on there and we were talking about the game. And then once we told them they could affect the game and gave them a few clues, they went nuts. To have 15,000 people, and by the end of it, 30,000 people, all trying to ruin your game. It was hilarious. Like, people generally, like, when you're playing it, it's really hilarious, because like you get the sense of personality of all the people watching, because like they will, the best of the trolls come out. And it was really satisfying for the people watching. They were so excited to see that they were actually having an impact. And one of the things that we added since that was what I'll give away on the show right now that I don't think we've really talked about much yet, which is hashtag block, which will block the goal temporarily for like a second or two. And what happens is, if you do that and then the ball gets blocked, it'll be blocked by, and it'll use your name, wherever you tweeted from or from Twitch. So it'd be like, you know, blocked by Mike Micah, blocked by Kevin, you know, whatever. And we've kind of run with that in some of the product or the testing, and people love that one, and it is really satisfying when you finally block the ball in the game.
Okay, so every time I've talked to you, you've always been, you know, very enthusiastic about video games in general, but it just sounds like this game is special. I don't want you to compare it like between this and like all the other games that you've worked on in the past, but you know, is there just kind of like a special? Is there a special feel behind this game? Because it just sounds like it is. There's so many great ideas, but there's also so many, you know, of the greatest hits of our past. It just seems to be just like you're making a game that you would always want to play and always have like on that, you know, pinned on that Xbox front panel.
You hit the nail on the head. This is something that happened so organically that I think it was inevitable that it would be something I really enjoyed, and everybody in the office really enjoys, because this is it really is kind of like, because we didn't have a publisher, we've worked so long with other people. Mm-hmm. When it's our own game and we're left to do whatever we want, but then on top of that, this extra layer of like reaching out to everybody we know online and allowing the public to kind of contribute as well, this has been, it's amazing. It's like one big jazz session with every, because people who follow me and respond to this game are all like game lovers, basically. Like, I have a really cool following of people. Whenever I tweet something that I think is like so kind of like arbitrary or weird or you know, very specific, I love the fact that like 10 people can respond within 5 minutes with like, oh, I love that really obscure thing you just said, because I had that when I was a kid or whatever. So making this game with all those people has been so satisfying, because it's like it reminds me of when I was a kid making games. I was like probably 12, 14 or something like that, and around that range when I was making Commodore 64 games. Mm-hmm. And I was basically making these games for my friends, because they would come over, we'd play it, and they would make all these suggestions. And then I would spend the next day or two putting all the suggestions in and invite them back over. And we would make the game more and more fun as we did that. This game was the exact same experience. So it's been so satisfying to have everybody throw in ideas, and very passionately throw in ideas, because they're all fans of these games. That's why it's like this. That's why it's like NBA Jam and all this stuff, because they would throw those ideas. They were kind of going back to their past, saying, I loved this about this game, and this game reminds me of it. I want it in there. And then when we put it in, and that it actually like scratched that itch, for instance, that's awesome. And I have a lot of me in this game. There's a lot of Kevin Wilson, who works here in the game, and the rest of the crew here. But there's also a lot of our friends who are in this game. And there's an incredible way to kind of like describe that or quantify it, in that when we've been showing this game around at all these shows, we are usually standing next to other developers showing off their games. And it started to happen slowly, and now it's kind of been an avalanche. We have teams of characters that are pre-baked in the game from all of our favorite games. So we have Oddworld characters in here. We have Double Fine characters in here. We have Capybara Game characters in here. This is almost like this all-star list of some of my favorite people that have come to help us out by allowing us to put their characters in the game and create teams for them.
which is awesome. Any luck with Bill Clinton yet, getting Bill Clinton in the game?
You know, I didn't reach out.
Okay.
But I have a feeling probably he should be in there just like NBA Jam.
That's I was playing some Sega Saturn NBA Jam TE today, and man, that game's great.
You get to be on fire in IDARB, and that's a direct nod to NBA Jam. And you know what? I almost put something in there. I didn't quite make it in there, but Mark Trammell, who worked on NBA Jam and NFL Blitz and all these things, I love the fact that he would, whenever there would be the like a rivalry, like say the Chicago Bulls versus Detroit Pistons. He's from Detroit.
Mm.
Even though your stats read one thing on the screen, he would make sure that when you're playing that rival, that you had the better stats as Detroit. So I think if you play as Emeryville, that's our studio here, you might notice some things.
Oh geez, now it's going to be, you're playing online, it's going to be all Emeryville. It's going to be like the LA Lakers of
2K. I'll let everybody off the hook. We didn't. I pulled it out because I just did it for internal testing, and it was awesome.
Jeez. All right. So you know, I know you guys don't have a date locked in, but we're hoping that people can see it sometime next year or at some point within the next 100 years. And I want to ask, I've asked you to describe the game, but all right. So now we got eight players, 4-on-4. What about for the people at home that have no friends? Is it a strictly a couch game, or is there online play? How does everything work?
So it is online.
Okay.
It was a weird thing because this game has been so organic. We didn't plan for it to be an online game, so we went back and reworked it so that we could play it online. But the way we had to do it, it's so fast paced, and there's 101 ways to do it. But because we were where we were, we created a couch versus couch online multiplayer. So if it's just you and you go online, you'll probably end up being matched against one other person, and it's a one-on-one game, which is perfectly fine. It plays great as one-on-one.
Okay.
But if you have two people at your house and you go on matchmaking, it will match you up with two other people. Or if it's three, it'll be three versus three or four versus four. And so that's the way we handle the online. We couldn't do – we attempted and fell short trying to do the eight individual Xboxes playing against each other. Mainly because of the latency issues and the amount of coordination that was required and the bandwidth we had and the pace that we do this game. Because when you do like a first-person shooter or if you're doing like an emulation or you do a lockstep-style game, which this didn't really start out as, you have some benefits. So like for Street Fighter, you can do frame rewind and, mm-hmm. and do all the subframe rewind stuff, which we couldn't really do with where we were without delaying the game for another 6 to 7 months or whatever. And then we could also do the just send everything over, but then the frame rate just crawls to nothing. So we found this like kind of perfect medium. So it's couch versus couch that works. And we also introduced a few other extra things here for online, because I was getting frustrated with online games, even in this generation, where I was running into lag and all stuff. And I didn't know if it was because it's my system or my connection or whatever. So we did this thing that now, like, it's pretty awesome because some other developers, after playing ours, are doing it too. So I hope it gets adopted because I love it, where it really gives you just the 5-bar system like a wireless for your phone.
Mm-hmm.
So it is doing a quality of service check on your connection, your bandwidth with the other player and all stuff, and it gives you bars at the top of the screen, so you know is the game like, do I just have a bad connection? Is the other player like really on a bad connection and that sort of thing? So you can kind of suss out what the issue is, and maybe as you get into a game, you're like, you know what, I don't want to deal with like a 2-bar game. I'm just going to abort out and find a different one and that sort of thing. So it gives you a little bit of feedback, so you don't have to be like halfway in the game and be like, I don't want to give up this or that because like I don't know what's causing this lag.
Why did developers stop doing that? I remember that was in like my NBA 2K and NFL 2K on the Dreamcast, and that you had like exactly what you said. It would be like 5 bars like from red to green, and they just stopped putting it in, I guess.
Yeah, and it's so useful because the minute you see that, like, you've got 1 bar, you immediately go to, like, well, I wonder if there's something wrong with my network. And mm-hmm. you'll, like, and more often than not, you'll look and be like, oh, yeah, I got to reset the router. I got to do this or whatever. But it's really frustrating when you're halfway in a game and then things start to get really messed up. And you're like, God, you just immediately blame the game because, like, they don't know how to make network games. But half the time, it's just some dumb thing. Like, somebody's, like, watching YouTube in the other room or something. And so to put the bars up, it really, I always thought was awesome. So we got that back now.
Yeah, today I'm amazed when people can have like 14 things hooked up to their wireless router. And trust me, I spent 2 hours with Comcast today trying to get my upload speed above 1 megabit per second, which
is so brutal.
Thankfully, after 2 trips to Comcast and 2 modems, I got a fix. But also, here's a lesson. I just bought my own modem on Amazon. Everyone should just go do that. Buy your own cable modem and you don't have to deal with this monstrosity of a cable modem plus a wireless router built into one device that Comcast is giving people these days. That's a rant for that's not related to any of this, but okay. I'm super excited about it, but just because like it is like lately I've been doing more of like just getting a couple people over, get two or three people over, and just every time just pulling out my Neo Geo, like my MVS, and playing some Windjammers and all the great stuff that's on there. And now with the downloadable games, like there's just so many great couch co-op and multiplayer games. But there isn't really like that NBA Jam game. Like there isn't that, I don't even know how to describe it. Like there's things like Nidhogg and stuff like that, and Gang Beasts, but there's not like, there isn't that almost like sports game, or like even that Bomberman game. Like there isn't really a Bomberman on any of these platforms right now.
Well, that's actually, I was feeling that way, and then Towerfall came out while we were kind of poking around with iDarb. And, at the time that Towerfall came out, I think our game had, like, 8 people running around shooting each other and all stuff. And I was like, well, this isn't going to really work out, but we'll see if we can make this different or whatever. But we loved Towerfall. And what Towerfall reminded me of, and what Nidhogg reminds me of and the stuff, is that we've gotten so far away from the game that could be like a visceral experience where you feel one-to-one with the controls. Mm-hmm. Like NBA Jam, that older NBA Jam, when you turned on a dime.
Yeah.
And where you wanted to go, you were there when you wanted to be there. And a lot of modern games have kind of gone away from that. It's like this really kind of, whether it's because of network needs or whatever, but it's like really kind of floaty. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel like, and the pace has been slowed down a lot. And I really miss that too, because I would go back to games like Bomberman and NBA Jam, and it's like they're so fast paced, and they're like you'd play a game and afterwards you're sweating, and you're like, because like your mind and your body were so engaged in trying to react so quickly, and also the mechanics were drawn out from a really simple system. Like if you look at Bomberman, it's one of the simplest systems ever conceived, but the complexity is so deep. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I think happened just by accident in a way, but also by the production process for iDarb. It was something that really started off simple, and the things we layered on as suggestions just kept refining it. But you still have the A is jump. You pull down to fall down faster. You can jump through some platforms and not, and that sort of thing. And you have a pass button. It's really as simple as that. There's like the shoot button, which is a trigger, X or the other trigger. And when you look at the control layout, it looks really, really simple. But then you realize you can do things like pass through a platform while somebody's in the air and they grab it. It gives you an alley-oop, which gives you 2x the score when you make a goal and all stuff. So there's all these like multipliers and all these cool things you learn later as you start playing and just like by accident stumble into. And so we've had people who excitedly tell us after they've been playing it for a while, like, I got a 15-point single shot. And they explain how they got it. And it's like they bounced off the ceiling. It went here. And it got to the 3x multiplier from the 5-point zone. And they got it in. And
so you got like hot spots. Like in,
we do.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, and in fact, like, and I don't even know them all. We've watched the AI get like a 60-point shot, and I have no idea how it did it. Like, I will see 60 points come up and be like, "What did it just do?" And I didn't capture it or anything. So, I will give one pointer. When somebody hash bombs the word hashtag bomb, mm-hmm. the bomb gives you a 2x multiplier. But there's a shot you can do that gives you at least 15 points from the 5-point zone. And if you have that bomb multiplier, that gives you 30 points in one shot. I've got that down. I figured that one out. But I have a feeling when it comes out, we'll see people getting those crazy 80, 100-point shots that are really difficult to do.
Man, I just can't wait till it comes out. And then you like look on the Amazon Mover and Shakers and you see like Xbox One controllers like going to the roof, because you're going to need those to fire them up. And actually, they are on sale come this holiday season. So I would stock up while you can. So yeah, okay. So this is super exciting. It's just it's nice to see, or it's just really cool to see it, you know, from where it was when you originally like started exchanging emails, and just from following you on Twitter these last couple of years and seeing how it's, you know, evolved from, like you said, it's from literally a post on Twitter to a full release that is going to be coming out on Xbox One sometime soon. So, man, it's nuts. I guess you got to be happy that things are wrapping up, but like you said, you're going to be continuing to iterate as the game is released.
Oh, I am. I am definitely going to be iterating. We right now we're in this holding pattern because we want it to come out And we're worried that, you know, that maybe there's going to be some like last minute glitch that comes up. So we're not touching the code right now. Mm-hmm. But we've been kind of banking up this like huge task list for the update.
Cool.
And we're looking at things like making sure that the online mode has some extra features and all that stuff, which we weren't able to really like dive fully into. But we also want to make sure we have a lot of space left for us to like react to what people are asking for and that sort of thing.
Of course. Another thing that just came out recently, at least at the time of this recording, was the documentary that finally came out on Xbox platforms. And you can, even if you're like an Xbox Live member, you can just stream it through the browser too. I went through the Xbox One, which is really nice. But Atari Game Over, which when I think we talked about last, they were premiering or talking a little bit about it at E3. And of course, it's the story of, or in part, the story of all those Atari carts that got buried in New Mexico, and you know, was E.T. the game that caused all this stuff to happen? Or I guess from what I learned from the documentary, no, Atari was just losing a ton of money and they couldn't sell these carts anymore, so the cheapest thing to do was to just throw them in a landfill. But you were part of this film, part of this documentary, and not only through interviews, but you also went to the site for the excavation, and I got to see the, I guess, old crushed Atari carts come out of the ground. And the first thing I want to ask you is, these things got sold on eBay. How do you feel about, you know, the town kind of selling them on eBay? Is this the right thing to do? And it seems like they also put some aside for museums as well.
Well, that's the thing, right? When they started to do this and they agreed to do it, part of the agreement, as I understand it, was that they would be able to sell some of this stuff, because they're right next to Alamogordo is right next to what's the site, the alien Roswell, right?
Oh yeah.
So they're really close to that, and Roswell has aliens, and when we're there, all the Alamogordo residents are like, we want the video games. Like, they can have aliens, we want video games. And so they're planning, I think, on having a little video game museum there. And
oh, cool.
Really playing it all out, which is awesome. And the people that are in the city council for Alamogordo were the people, there were kids at the time who were stealing the games from the landfill.
No way.
So it's funny because like they're all there to supervise, and they all have stories. Every single person that was walking up there had some story, or they brought the games they stole when they were kids from the landfill. Mm-hmm. And it was awesome. It was really cool to see all these people kind of get together in this city. It's a very small city. And when they started to sell these online, I was actually rooting for them to go for a lot of money, because this is something that can actually help the city. Like, totally. I was talking to the mayor. I forgot her name right now off the top of my head, but she was in the documentary for a moment. And she was like, because we were joking around, I was hanging out with Ernie Klein, and Ernie's like, well, I get in trouble if I, you know, end up speeding down, you know, whatever. And so she's like, well, you would, but we don't have any like radar guns. We're hoping we can sell some of these games to buy radar guns. And so she's like, go ahead and speed all you want. We can't catch you. And
as a pro tip, if you're ever driving through there.
Yeah. Although, you know, after these sales, maybe they have them now.
True.
So it was great meeting all these people who were actually, you know, they're really behind it. They saw it as an opportunity to help the city, both like put it on the map, so to say, as well as to help fund some things and that sort of thing. And they're going to probably make it more of a destination sort of thing too, so you can go and see these games. But it was amazing to be there. It was one of the craziest days of my life, for sure. And to be there with so many people I knew and who, you know, had some sort of effect on my career, like Howard, for instance.
Yeah.
The guy's amazing. He's one of the first video game developers I've ever met in my life. And when I was still living in Michigan, I was just homebrew making this Yars Revenge game. And a friend of mine said, hey, I've got Howard's email address. He had it on some forum. And he's like, you should write him and show him the game you're working on. And I was just doing this as like a side project, as like this bizarre, like just then people were learning about the Game Boy and how to make games on it, mm-hmm. Outside of the official stuff. And so I emailed him on a lark, and like within minutes he wrote back. And we started talking. I was showing him stuff online, and he's like, well, where are you? And I'm like, well, I'm in Michigan or stuff. And he's like, I'm going to be there next week, and I'm going to be over here. I'm really close to where we are. Like, why don't we get together and just, you know, have some drinks, talk, show me the game and all that stuff. So we got together, and I spent the entire night listening to that guy. I was mesmerized. He had all these stories. It was amazing. And at this time, this was way back in, I don't know, it was probably like 93, 94 at the time. And you just didn't hear this stuff. This was still when game journalism was just about what games are coming out. Nobody was really thinking about behind the scenes things back in the 80s and that stuff. So it was just amazing. Stuff that you take for granted now, hearing these stories like what happened at Atari and that sort of thing, was just awesome.
we're back from the break, so you got to hear some awesome video game music. I was playing some Sonic R today, so it might have been from that, but probably not, because I think that music is kind of crazy and weird. It's like the perfect Persona equivalent for the Sega Saturn. But yeah, Mike, I want to ask you, just in terms of, you know, what they dug up there, it wasn't just ET carts, but there was you know, a bunch of other stuff. I don't know if you have any idea of just like how much stuff in total. I think the last scene was just a huge garage full of boxes of, you know, supposedly games and stuff like that that was dug up. But I don't know if you have any idea what they're able to actually get out of there.
Yeah, so we were there for the whole duration of them pulling these games out. And where they it may not have been covered too much in the documentary. I didn't see the bonus material, so maybe there's some more in there. But the way they had buried these games is they had one lower layer that was, I forgot how many, hundreds of feet or whatever. And when they put that in, like over the next few days, people were going in there and taking games. So they ended up paving over that. And then they put another layer of games and paved over that. But at the end of this trench, they kind of, to save money, just stopped paving. And so there were all these games that were pouring out of like the end of the trench. And that's where they dug, because they didn't want to dig through the cement. They wanted to get to the end at the trench where it was like the overrun of games there. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're like on their fifth try trying to figure out where it was, and then they hit pay dirt. And when they started pulling these things up, they pulled out probably, I think, 1,200 games, maybe, if I remember correctly. Maybe a little bit more than that. But you got to remember, they're in the boxes and stuff like that, too. And they're in the shipping crates, too, because some of these games weren't most of them weren't even pulled out of the 6-unit shipping box and that sort of thing, too. So they're pulling these things out and just kept pulling them out. And it was pretty clear after they started digging that, you know, the irony was the first bunch they brought out, I think, had like an ET in it and a couple other things that were from like Target. And the rest of it, though, that started coming up, we didn't see any more ET games for the longest time. It was in ironies of all ironies. There was like Yar's Revenge was in there, Atari 5200 games, which at the time was kind of a new system. Mm-hmm. All these things started coming out of the ground, and it started to paint the picture that, you know, at the end of the day, this was just every retail return. There wasn't just a game to blame, or that was just like overstocked or whatever. This was everything Atari had. There were game systems, there were game cartridges, there were game peripherals. Everything was piled into here. And there was this gentleman there, which I think he gets some time in the bonus materials. I haven't seen them yet, but Jim Heller, who was awesome. He was the guy who got the call to bury the games. And he was working out of the Santa Fe distribution center, I believe, or their warehouse. And what had happened is this is a warehouse where they would put games and then ship them out to stores and that sort of thing. It started to become a holding like place for all the returns coming from retailers.
Wow.
And some of the photos and stuff that he had of these like pallets of games floor to ceiling in this gigantic warehouse, it really painted the picture of this was just out of control. And Atari started nosedive, and he got the call. He'd been with Atari since the beginning, I think. And he was the guy who had to, of course, like let people go and also deal with all this overstock and everything. So he did all this hard work. He got the games destroyed or, you know, buried up in Alamogordo, did all this stuff. And then I think after being the axe man and all this stuff in the classic case, I think he got axed after that. And then that was kind of the end of it. But he had folders of all the – he had exact numbers of what was buried. He had photos of them on the day they were burying them and all the stuff that he had in his possession, which was amazing to see that day.
So how much stuff was down there? Was it like – was it tens of thousands?
I think it did get up to – well, there. I think – I don't know what the number was off the top of my head, but it was 18 semi-trailers, I think.
Oh, that's a ton. That is –
yeah,
oh my God.
That is a lot. And so those 18 trucks made their way there over like a course of some days or something like that and buried all that stuff. And it's funny talking to the locals too, because I remember it was a big news in the town. Mm-hmm. And that's the irony of it, because like – it's been this mystery and people are like, what did they bury and where was it buried and all this stuff. But like to the people in Alamogordo, this was like no mystery at all. They're like, of course, we were there. And like I have a whole Atari collection thanks to it and stuff like that.
Wow.
Because like when these things came in, they said like every store, every shop and every person you knew had an Atari system in almost every game because they got it somehow from that dump.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing is that, you know, people have been saying this story, but it just sounds so incredible. Because if you think of all those games and all those systems that they just – that were so worthless to them that it saved them money to just put them in a dump than to even leave them in a warehouse, that is what is unbelievable about it. And that's why you know, so many people thought, no, it can't be true. Like, why would they just throw all these games out there? You got to at least be able to get like a buck a piece for them from the local, you know, like you said, Target, or if there was like a KB Toys or something back then.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? Like, if you go back and you hear the stories, people are like, we tried to give it, like, we tried to just tell the retailers, here, we'll give you your money back, but just you deal with it. And these retailers insisted they take it all back. And so it got to that point to where they couldn't give it away, even if it meant like any store could try to profit off it. And there were some chains like I think it was like Circus World and stuff that at the time took Atari up on that and took any kind of overstock they could. And they were selling games for like a dollar. You saw like closeout stores and stuff like that getting stuff. But even then, that wasn't enough to get rid of it all. They couldn't funnel it to these stores fast enough because there wasn't enough people buying them at that point.
Jeez. All right. Well, that is that's almost kind of depressing. But let's talk about another facet of the story was, you know, needing to get E.T. done in 5 weeks. So you've created or you've developed a lot of games. You've worked on a lot of games. I got to ask, and it seems like this is kind of common, but do you have any deadline stories? Just like any crazy, like, yeah, you have to get this done in, you know, such and such a time. And you're like, this is no way we can do it. But it just like, you know, happened. Like what? Any stories like that?
My favorite, and I can't believe. Tell me if I've said this story on here before, but did I tell the story of Klax for Game Boy Color, the one that I had my wife's marriage proposal in? But the development of that game was outrageous. I don't know if I've talked about that before or not.
I believe so, but it was like we're talking 10 months ago.
Yeah, exactly. I'll recap quick, but in the context of all this, we went to Atari of all companies. It's like the end of Atari again. When it was before it went to Hasbro, I think, and it was still kind of like midway and they didn't split it off again. And we wanted to work on Klax. We thought that was a fun puzzle game. It'd be really good for Game Boy Color. So Robert Daly, who's a producer over there, he had just finished up, I think, one of the arcade Gauntlet games, the newer ones for like that was also on N64. And he was also one of the he did like the Wayne Gretzky hockey games and stuff like that. He's a good friend of ours. And he's like, well, yeah, you could totally do that. But we don't have much money, and if you can do it, like, can you do it in 6 weeks? And it was almost the same thing that Howard kind of dealt with. There's a little bit of hubris because we had been shipping all these Game Boy games. They seemed like, you know, we're on a roll and we weren't doing any wrong. And it's like, 6 weeks? Yeah, let's do it. And so it was the exact same thing. I was like, Chris Charla, who's head of ID at Xbox now, he was on that project with me. And I remember we worked day and night. We would be working when we weren't in the office. We didn't want to get like distracted. We took our laptops and we all went to the Oakland Public Library over here and worked out of the library to try to like stay focused. And we managed to get pretty ahead of the schedule in just 6 weeks that we put in, I think, 6 mini games as well. We had like this snake game hidden in there. We had in the European version, we actually have a full version of Adventure with updated graphics. So the Atari Adventure game.
What?
it's true.
Wait. Would you say that you were crunched for time? You had time to completely.
I don't know. I look back and I'm going like, I remember it being so awful, but like we managed to sneak in so much stuff. Like I snuck in a marriage proposal for my wife that if you put in a certain code, it's how like I proposed to her. And we had all these things in there. We were doing things like using the Game Boy printer before Nintendo shipped a game that used it. And so, yeah, so I don't know how we did that, but the 11th hour, like we're putting all this stuff in just for whatever we thought we're like doing great. But then right before, I think it was probably 3 days before we had to ship it out because this is still in the age of having to get it manufactured and getting it shipped over on boat and everything. And it was going to miss, you know, a big window just like E.T. It's crazy, but it wasn't as big a license as E.T. So I don't think anybody would have cared.
I don't know, man. Klax is a pretty dope game. And that's been released on like everything that has ever been produced.
When I was given the catalog of Atari games and I'm like, I want to do Klax. Like, I really like Klax.
I think that was the very first unlicensed game I ever rented too, because I rented that a couple times on the NES from Tengen.
I love the game. I thought the style was crazy and all stuff. And one thing I really liked was the game logic. Like, there's the ways you can get the multiple, like the multipliers and stuff. So if you get the X and you get all stuff, and if you can chain up a lot of the you know block resolutions and stuff. So that was the thing that screwed us 3 days before shipping too, because we had done all this stuff. We'd even talked to the original developers, who I don't know where they were at the time, just to get everything down. We felt really good, and we're putting all this extra stuff in, and then we get the call from QA that the puzzle logic is not matching to the arcade game. And so they would give us all these cases, and we would do it, and we'd go through our code, and we're like, this does exactly what it's supposed to do. We'd look at the C source code of the arcade game and go, okay, that's what it's supposed to do. And there's some parts of the arcade game we didn't have the source code to, and also, so we kind of isolated where it's like, okay, that other source we don't have, we got to figure out what's there. So we ended up calling Dave Akers, who was on the game originally, and he explained, he said, like, well, that's kind of funny because this gives me kind of deja vu with a lot of the logic in the game. He's like, I had originally created the logic in Amiga Basic, I believe it was. And he's like, and it worked great, but then we put it in C, it just didn't behave the same. Mm-hmm. And so he said, we worked really hard to get the order of operation kind of issues that were working in BASIC to work in C. And it took a while, and we finally figured it out. But he said, that's where the kind of trick was. And so we did the logic with 3 days left, and now probably around 2.5, maybe less. We're against the clock, and we're starting to really sweat it. We created the game. We took the game logic, and we recreated it in QBASIC in hopes of like it shedding some light on what BASIC would do. And as soon as we did that, in just a matter of like, probably took an hour, it worked perfect. But then we then took that and we went line by line and created the order, in the same order of operations, everything into Z80 code, exactly the same thing, and it just refused to work the same way. And the Hail Mary that we did here was we basically created a Z80 basic interpreter based off this open source thing we found online. I put it in to feed the game logic to this basic interpreter, and for whatever reason, the results came out exactly what they're supposed to be, no matter how much we tried to do it in proper Z80. I'm sure if I go back now and looked at it without the pressure, I might be able to figure it out. But at the time, that was the only option we had. So we embedded a basic emulator in Clax to feed the game logic state into and then spit it back out to put back into the game so that the logic of the puzzles would be exactly like the arcade game.
Jeez.
And we handed that thing off, I think, probably with like an hour to spare to go to master. And we were worried because like we put that in, and Atari was worried because like no QA was really given on it. And like this thing could go and mess everything up. So our hope was that when we got it and went to the manufacturing plant over the next 2 days, QA would pound on it and we could try to, you know, pull the ROM and replace if we had to. But it all held up and it shipped. It was a scary, scary production.
So that is literally up to the last hour that you could possibly get it done, and you just finished it the last second.
Exactly. And I still hear these stories. There was a friend of ours who was shipping a PS4 game that was like right to beyond the limit it takes to ship a PS4 game, mm-hmm. and still managed to pull it off just in time. And you hear it all the time. It's amazing. We're just talking about this even in regards to iDARB, even though we're done and all this stuff, and now it's kind of gone into the queue for getting ready for release, and we'll have some news soon. But you do this sort of like flying it in hot. Mm-hmm. And it's harder now than you used to be, even in the days of making cartridges, because now organizations are so large that like the fire marketing and PR and all these guys, and getting them to move at the same pace is really difficult and challenging. So even though we're done with like iDARB and we flew it in super hot, we still have to have those guys do their job, and they're waiting on us. So it's really hard to deal with that.
Yeah, I always got weirded out. Like, not weirded out, but I always thought the logo was super weird with the hand as the K or however they did it. But Clax is a game. If you haven't tried it and you like puzzle games and games that will kind of get your heart rate going a little bit, definitely check it out. Even came out on the Atari 7800. So if you want to try out that version, it is available to you. And on the Atari Lynx. Like, it came out on everything.
Genesis, Lynx. We did the Game Boy version. There was another Game Boy version before ours that was black and white. And, it was Amiga. And just the list goes on and on. Commodore 64. It was a fun puzzle game. It was one of my favorites.
You got to guess that, or I would have to figure that Atari, like the Atari's library, you know, their handful of games have just been ported so many times, whether it be... Oh God, like if you just think about like we were talking about the, you know, Atari like arcade collections and just all the different versions during the time of the NES and the Mega Drive or the Sega Genesis and the Game Boy, like that was a time when if a game came out, it came out in the NES, Super Nintendo, Genesis, Game Gear, Game Boy, like Atari Lynx. Everything. It's nuts. But now you just have two platforms and then PC. So okay, let's, I don't know, Joe, do you have any other like crazy deadline stories or just like any, like you said, like Hail Marys of the last second? Like you've worked on, I don't even know if you, off the top of your head, how many games you've worked on professionally?
You know, to varying degrees, I've worked on probably over 160 now.
Oh God. Okay.
Yeah. So there, it becomes a blur. Like when you say like the 11th hour stories, I'm like, yeah, there's probably like probably like 40 of those things where you're like racing the car down to a place to get in on a or a CD down to a plane or that sort of stuff. But yeah, Clax is probably the most challenging one. That would probably be the most challenging one. Although I'm trying to think now, we did a game called Disney's Tarzan for Game Boy Color as well.
I own that. Yeah, I remember I just bought that like a couple months ago.
Oh, so that one was a 3-month production. But when you're working with like Disney and like you have Disney animators helping you do sprites and all stuff, that one was brutal too, because at one point the game was meant to be color and black and white, so backwards compatible. And we just were not going to be able to ship it on time. And we were dealing with a gentleman named Steve Crane over at Activision who was very patient. But he's like, you know, if we go to Game Boy Color, we have no – because this is at the time that Game Boy Color kind of just came out. He's like, if we do that, we are going to potentially lose like 20 million gamers like that we had built this forecast on.
Yeah.
He's like, that's just not an option. It's not an option. And we just kept doing the – we just kept telling him there's no – we're going to miss the date. And this movie, day and date for movie games at that time were, you know, life and death.
Yeah.
And so finally, at one point, he, after like, I think we got down to like shouting matches, and where it's like, it's either late or you do this. They opted for, okay, we'll go color only. But then they asked us that we make a black and white version compatible one later, that they can kind of like, if it looks like the IP and the movie's going to do really well, we're like, fine, we'll kind of do that. So then we had to pull out all the stuff they had before that was going to make it challenging. And we, even by pulling that stuff out, we were going to be against the clock. And so we worked, again, another day, like probably for a month and a half, just nonstop around the clock. And I think we lost a few people along the way who just couldn't hack it and basically quit. And by the time we got to the day of shipping, we kind of got it out there and it was color only. And like Activision would just told us they didn't want to work with us again and all stuff. The game came out. And it outsold the N64 and the PlayStation versions combined, and it was like a memory eraser, like from Men in Black or whatever. It was just actors were super happy. They wanted to sign us up for 5 more games and like all this stuff. And it was a lesson to me that like as long as you deliver, no matter how like bad things get, like they only remember the success or the failure, but not what it took to get there. And so that was a tough one, because I thought like my days making games for Activision or maybe making games in general were going to be over if we didn't pull this thing off, and to have it like be something where it's like on my shoulders to be the guy who says like, sorry, but we have to do this. That was tough.
Yeah, and if people are looking up for Game Boy games, like, not, you know, that wasn't super common to have just the Game Boy Color only games. Like, those were kind of hard to find. I remember looking out for those, and I think I bought Rampage. Now, maybe that, I don't know if Rampage was backwards compatible or not, but that was my first Game Boy Color game that had any color whatsoever.
Yeah, like the NFL Blitz game I did was a backward compatible game, and the best way to play it is on Game Boy Color. If you put it in black and white, it runs at half the speed. And people were playing it in black and white and hated the game more than it normally was. It wasn't a great game. But it was one of those things where, like, if you went to color, you had the benefit of getting a faster processor, but also you got this DMA transfer capability like the Super Nintendo had to move memory around basically in tandem with what you're doing on the processor. So it was awesome to have that ability. And once we put Tarzan out there and we actually had those sales numbers, which it was selling great, we were able to use that case to make almost all our games Game Boy Color only after that.
But before we wrap up, I want to talk about some prototypes. You know, on Twitter, a couple, maybe it was about a week ago now, or maybe it was less than that, you talked about a prototype that you made for Death Junior, which was a PSP release, but you were working on a DS release of that game, and you started sharing some of that. So you still do have some of the materials, or do you even have the code for Death Junior for the DS? And I guess I want to ask you, what was that game going to be compared to the PSP release, and you know, what's left of it?
So I was talking in the office about this kind of like rendering technology software that I was working on at one point, and I knew I had the source code for it, so I started to dig for it. And as I was digging for the source code, I started to find all this stuff. I found prototypes. I found like old games that I'd worked on. And I had forgotten about Death Junior DS, and I found that. And so I have DS and PC source. So it was kind of like it was developed to run on either or in like early development. The DS side kind of works like where it's supposed to be, but the PC simulation of that is still intact. And so I got to go through it, and I think I can clean up the DS and get that kind of running too. But the game, so we had just shipped Death Jr., and Konami was seeing that the DS was starting to, you know, get a little bit more popular and sell a lot more. And it started to look pretty clear that the DS was going to overtake the PSP. And so Konami came to us and said, like, you know, we'd love to put this on DS. What would you do with it? And to me, the DS architecture wasn't really friendly for 3D. So I wanted to kind of go back to one of my favorite games and figure out if I could do a multiplayer version of that, which was Super Metroid. I love Super Metroid. And I love Castlevania. So I was like, this is like back in the days before it was really in vogue to be a Metroidvania game. So It was like, I think we're all thinking the same thing at the same time. But I really wanted to kind of merge those kind of gameplay styles together. So I was working on a 2D version of Death Jr. that allowed for multiplayer. I wanted to have both screens be your co-op. So you would see, if I were playing with somebody else on another DS, I would see their screen on the bottom, and then we'd flip that on the other one. So you could always be aware of where the other person was and be able to play like a game like that together. And so that's what the demo, what you see in this little video I had, and I've got more of it, where your one person stands on a switch to open door while the other person goes through, and then you can get like this thing that's kind of like a rocket launcher. But you know, it was just a fun co-op Metroidvania style game that I was shooting for. But ultimately, we ended up not having the time in our studio to work on the DS game because they quickly greenlit the second PSP game. Mm-hmm. And so our Vancouver studio took the reins on it, and they were really hell-bent on making a 3D action game very similar to the PSP version. And there were a lot of challenges in that production. It didn't quite come out the way any of us wanted it to, even our Vancouver studio. So to find the 2D version of Death Jr. was a little bit like bittersweet, where it's like, oh, that's the thing that could have been.
Death Jr. is a weird franchise because the GameStop that I worked at in college, we had a very healthy PSP wall. Lots of college kids seem to have PSPs, but that was a game that I just always saw. Like, we always had a bunch of copies, and people always bought copies of Death Jr. for whatever reason. I ended up picking up a copy just because it was like one of those things where you work at GameStop, you can take home any game that you want, really, yep, as long as you don't destroy it and bring it back to saleable condition. But that is like one of those core PSP franchises that people don't really think about when they think about PSP, but you guys seem to have sold a ton of those Death Jr. games.
We did. We were one of the best-selling PSP games, and we had done a follow-up, Death Jr. 2, I think it's Roots of Evil. Mm-hmm. And that did really well. But the thing that was always kind of challenging was like the budgets weren't as healthy as we always wanted. And like the quality of the first game was pretty good. The second one was a lot better. Mm-hmm. But I think at the time, the investment we had to put into that game versus what we got in the end, when we're a much larger company and like had a lot more mouths to feed, it became challenging to keep that series going when in all respects, it was a successful franchise and the money we got was really great, but we ended up having to redirect that money to other things. So, to be able, I would have loved to have kept going with Death Jr., but it was just financially, it just didn't make sense, even though the games were doing really well. But it was a frustrating time because we had a whole team, the game was really, we had tons of fans, we had comics that were selling great through Image Comics, and there's a demand for those. It got adopted into the American Library Association's track, so like the Death Jr. comic for a long time was in every elementary school in the U.S. and like it was on this like rocket ship, just cruising as fast as it could, and it kind of whimpered out because of just the notion that we were just growing too big and too fast, and a franchise I think would have benefited from another game.
Yeah, when are we going to see another game with C4 hamsters in it?
I've got a C4 hamster on my shelf right next to me right now.
There you go. Maybe we'll type hashtag C4 hamster coming to
iDarb. We had at one point in the game, we actually had every C4 hamster had a bio. We like had written up like 250 of these biographies for every hamster and why they were so dedicated to becoming like an explosive hamster. It was a little too creepy because then like all this terrorism stuff came up, so we pulled it last minute.
Good call. Yeah. Good call. And also we talked last time you were on the show, and again through the magic of Twitter and sharing this stuff with the audience, is that through some, you know, going through boxes when your brother was moving, stumbled upon a zip disk full of what could be a Bomberman prototype on the Atari Jaguar. So the audience will kill me if I don't ask. So any update on the state of that, or if we'll ever get to see what that is?
Definitely. So, I mean, Bomberman was a game we had started to work on with Hudson Soft and Atari back in 94, I believe. And we got it pretty far, and we would upload it to like the Atari like FTP site or whatever it was. But there was a shared FTP. It was a lot like PartnerNet that Xbox had last generation, where you could see everybody else's games and all that stuff. So basically, we had got to a certain point, and then Atari went under, and it was fully playable. It was awesome. We loved it. And it just kind of disappeared. And my brother had kept a copy of it, and he also had it on his laptop. When he moved out to California, my brother and his friends stopped at the St. Louis Arch or whatever. And while they were kind of just sightseeing, somebody broke into the truck and took his laptop. And he at the time thought that was the only copy he had, was what was on the hard drive there. And his plan was, you know, get settled in and then just start backing things up and doing stuff. But he didn't have time before he moved. So we're like, oh, we just now lost Bomberman. And so after that, I started calling up people who I knew were on that FTP site, because we had other developers who we would email with all the time. They would download Bomberman and play it on their side and give us feedback and stuff. So I was trying to track all those people down. None of them kept copies of it. Everybody remembered it, but they never kept any copies. So I thought it was kind of lost. And so when I was helping my brother pack to move now a few months ago to go down to Burbank, we're in his garage, and he was just like, well, look what I found and stuff. And written on it was, you know, Bomberman, Jaguar, or whatever. And so later on, after we kind of got everything packed away, he checked out and he confirmed that it is the Bomberman source. We don't know exactly which version, but it looks like it's pretty intact. And so when he went down to Burbank, I asked him, like, just back it up, which he's done. And I'm like, well, we'll hand this off to somebody who can maybe get it all up and running and maybe go ahead and get it out there somehow. And but he met somebody down there in Burbank who has the full-on Jaguar development kit and everything, all kind of a Jaguar enthusiast. And so he's working right now.
The one Jaguar enthusiast in the country, exactly. In the world.
Jeez. Believe it or not, there's probably five, let's be honest.
Sure.
Considering the billions of people on the earth. And so he's been working with that guy to get it up and running. And I don't know what the latest progress is, but I have people asking me about it constantly. And I feel their pain, because I'm usually that guy too. Rest assured, everybody, my brother's on it, and he's really wanting to make sure that it's cleaned up and at least like in a good enough state to release it and have everybody else be able to play it. And I am super curious, because I have not seen it in action at all, and I'm going to be seeing him for Thanksgiving, so hopefully I get to see some of it. He's really concerned about being the first guy in, because it was a lot of it was his code. He wants to make sure everything's like kind of tight and ready to go and that sort of thing. So good news is it looks like it's pretty intact, and it looks like it's a later version. We don't know. I don't know yet like what state it's really in. And but the notion or the plan is to get it to a state that it can be released and people can enjoy it and see what could have been on Jaguar.
Gotta fire up those Jaguars and get your 8,000 button Jaguar controller out.
Open up those three copies of White Men Can't Jump to get the multi-tap, or two of them at least, and get that multi-tap out.
Oh, man, that's right. If you want a multi-tap for your Jaguar, do it right now. See, this is what the show is all about. It's all about consumer awareness to buy stuff. And it sounds like a joke, but every time we do an episode, you can always go on eBay and see how the prices jump up.
Yeah.
When people start remembering, oh, yeah, I totally remember that game. I need to buy it for my collection.
Yeah, and also like just recently with that, like the way you can get homebrew now on a 3DS was through that one game, like Cube, Cube Ninja, I think. And I'm like, oh, that's right. I just read the story. I'm like, that's cool. And I went to eBay, and it's already every price was inflated. I'm like, this is a game that should be like $2.
Yep.
And you can't get it for under like 60 now or something like that.
Yeah, it's the magic of the internet these days that you can, I guess, consumerism is alive and well. But the Atari Jaguar is something that I remember sitting in a Leechmere, which is like a department store in Massachusetts, and like seeing it at $100 and seeing it at $99 and seeing it at $49. And like every single time I went in there, I would try to ask if I could get one, because it had an awesome, super awesome version of Doom on it.
Yep.
And that's all I really cared about at the time, because all I had access to was the Super Nintendo version of Doom, which while pretty impressive with the Super FX chip, was not like what was going on in the Jaguar. Like, it was full screen and it looked awesome.
I was actually impressed because when we went to that show and we were just trying to convince anybody to give us development hardware, like Atari was the one that give it to us. But they gave us all these demos, and it was at the time, it's like near the end of it, obviously, when we started doing Bomberman. But they had these incredible demos with the Jaguar CD, which added a little extra firepower. Mm-hmm. And one of them was a game that played and was very familiar to Star Wars the arcade game, but with filled textures and polygons and all stuff. And I remember like turrets are turning around and shooting at you, and it was really fast-paced. The frame rate was really great. And I remember seeing that going like, well, you know what? Like, all the stuff that's on cartridge and all stuff, that's great. But this game is just amazing. And it was a demo they were giving out to every developer to have of a game that was a work in progress. And I still, to this day, I'm sure people who are the Jaguar enthusiasts, or they know exactly what I'm talking about. But that turned me around on Jaguar. I saw that. And then Iron Soldier I thought was pretty good too. And of course, Tempest 2000 I think goes without saying. But those games were kind of unique to Jaguar, whereas Doom, I think that was one of the best copies of Doom as well at the time, or versions of Doom. So these games were very unique and only on that platform. And that gave me a little bit of hope for Jaguar, even though I saw the writing on the wall for everything else. And if only they had gotten some of those games that were in development out, if they could have done it a year before, I think they would have changed people's minds about the platform. But as it stood, and also based off the way the architecture was constructed, I really didn't have a chance against the new machines.
Oh man! Like if you want to, just typing in Atari Jaguar on Google, you start seeing pictures of people's complete Jaguar and Jaguar CD collections.
Yeah.
From Atari age, and man, there was some really good titles on that thing. They actually got some good support.
That's what happens is like when people come over, I have the Jaguar. It's one of the systems that I usually bring out because people want to see more obscure things.
Sure.
And I'm like, you know, here's this thing. And they usually go in saying, like, man, that system was awful. But then you pull out a certain selection of games, you put them in, and people are like, this isn't so bad. This is pretty cool. But there's this reputation it has. It's like the Atari ET sort of thing where, you know, the real lemons are the things that stood out. And when people really made the architecture sing and did some really cool things, that wasn't enough to change perception.
It seems to be like with the Sega Saturn for me, like I've been collecting a lot of the Midway, or you just want to say like Western based arcade games that like we got versions of on the Super Nintendo and the Sega Genesis. But for a lot of those games that came out in like 92, 93, like there's arcade perfect versions of those games on the Sega Saturn. Like NBA Jam plays better literally than it does on an arcade machine because you also have CD sound.
The thing about Saturn is it's a 2D powerhouse.
Exactly.
And its biggest flaw was that it came out at the advent of the expectation of 3D games. And if it could, like in hindsight, when you go back and you see this stuff, it's just amazing what it can do in 2D.
Yeah.
It just kills the competition. And it can still do cool things on that hardware in 2D that that now I think people are more acceptable of, like, you know, 3D doesn't matter as much anymore. It's just how cool is the game. And if we only had that attitude back then, I think Saturn would have had a better chance too. Like Sonic, if you're reading like Console Wars and all stuff, if Sonic could have just been an amazing 2D game on the Saturn, there's a chance it could have changed minds, even though everybody was really like challenged by 2D at the time. But I think in hindsight, history would have been way more kind to the Saturn had there been an amazing Sonic game that came out for it in 2D.
I don't know. I can see its failure. The console failed because a couple days ago I was streaming some Revolution X, and the version of Revolution X on that thing is terrible. Like it's super.
Well, people get like even the developers gave up on it after a certain point because you know here's the reality, right? You're working on Saturn, and you're like, this is great. We can do all this stuff, and it's a little bit tough, but we can do this. And then suddenly Sony drops off a development kit to this like thing from the future, and nobody wants to work on the Saturn anymore. They want to like work on that thing that has that 3D dinosaur demo and try to like make crazy things that you've never seen before. And that's kind of what happened. It was probably Sony's secret weapon. They just gave people dev kits with amazing technology.
Here, look at Ridge Racer. Racer.
It's amazing. Like Ridge Racer is what sold me. The minute I saw Ridge Racer, I was like, it's over. Yeah. I got to have this. There's nothing else I want.
Okay, I think we're almost an hour and a half. So this is what happens. It just turns into me talking to Mike about games. There is a big collection aspect of this show. So I was just wondering if there's there's anything that's kind of popped up in your collection recently, if there's anything that's worth noting or anything like that.
Well, you know, I did get the production company for the Atari Dig sent me a copy of E.T. and I think I got Phoenix from the Dig. So that's pretty cool. It's a really nice copy of E.T. that came out of the landfill.
How'd you not get Yar's Revenge?
Well, you know what? Like, I think those were pretty much taken by the time they got to me, which, you know, it seems like, you know, I'm in the movie and stuff like that. I should have got whatever. But I remember when we were looking at a list and they're like the things we wanted, I put Yar's Revenge as like the second choice and they said they just didn't have them. I have a feeling like everybody just wanted to get the Howard games.
Sure.
And like by the time it got to me, it's like they're all gone except for you got an E.T. So I've got those, and then I've actually been rediscovering things I have in the collection. So I've been kind of going through some of the prototypes, and I posted some of them, but finding the Clay Fighter Extreme PlayStation again, and going into it a little bit deeper. Like I didn't know much of the lore of the Clay Fighter stuff, but then people were really curious who Hobo Cop was, and so I'm looking in, and I'm like, oh, this version has Hobo Cop. So I posted a little video of that and stuff like that. So I've been kind of going through these things and doing a little bit of a deeper dive to see what I actually have. I've talked about it, I knew I had it somewhere, but I thought I had lost it at some point. The Game Boy Color version of Gunsmoke that we had worked on. And it was cool to see that. So it's the NES Gunsmoke, essentially, on Game Boy Color. And the game was mostly done. Like, a lot of the audio was missing. But it was one of those things where Capcom's like, we just don't think it's going to sell. And that was kind of killed off. And then, I found the Agent 9 demo that we had, which I don't know if I've talked about this before, but Agent 9 was the monkey with a gun in Spyro. And Universal wanted to do an offshoot series. And so what they had done is they actually started talking to two developers. One of those were the developers was Digital Eclipse and Backbone, which was where I was. And there was another developer outside of that. And we didn't know about each other working on the demo. And so we were making it for GameCube, and we got this mechanic where you're this monkey running around, you have this gun, but the gun isn't just a gun. It was like a Dig Dug gun. You can fire off this tethered thing that would latch onto bad guys. You could pump them up and then use them as balloons to get up to higher levels and shoot them off and knock over other people like bowling pins and all that stuff. So I found that as well for GameCube, which is pretty cool. So I'm going to try to get some video of that pulled together.
Very cool. All right. So you got some actual, like, one of a kind stuff coming.
Yeah, definitely. And then I got those. This, you probably talked about this on your show before, but you sent me those two books. The one like the console history book and then the handheld history book from Japan. Who actually made those books?
I actually have them right here.
Those are awesome.
Yeah, these are two books that if you've been following like Mark McDonald and stuff like that, like I brought them in to show those guys. But these are two books that came out, I guess, 2 years ago in Japan that, this is for context, like the portable version, the very last thing on the dust cover, it says the future, and right under it is a PlayStation Vita. So that gives you a context in terms of the dates. But these are books that literally have every single handheld that was ever released in Japan, everything from the Wonder Swan to all the different variations of the Game Boy, the Super Game Boy, anything that would play portable consoles, even the LCD games and the Game & Watch type games. And every single one of them has beautiful, like, full-colored pictures with descriptions on them. And unfortunately, we cannot read this stuff. But it is great to just go through and look at, like, oh my God, I did not know there was, like, you know, all these different versions of the whatever, like the 3DO hardware. Like, I didn't know there was.
It's really comprehensive.
Yeah.
And I was surprised by some of the stuff in there. I was really surprised by some of the really early stuff too. I had not known that some of those Coleco style systems, some of them probably originated from Japan, but the variations of them that actually exist in Japan versus the one version we had here. And that sort of thing was really eye opening. So thanks for picking those up for me too. By the way, that, when I saw you tweet about that, I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing.
And you think like something like this would be like $40 or $50 a piece, but these were like $13.
Oh, you know, that reminds me too. I had just ordered now the Sega Genesis.
Yeah.
That production hardbound book that was on Kickstarter. Have you seen this?
I ordered one too. It was. God,
it's so good.
It's like $60, but yeah, if you think about it, that's like $0 when you think about how much awesome stuff is in
Frank
there.
Frank Cifaldi here got it the other day, and I immediately ran because I had forgotten to pick that up and order it right away. And it is so awesome. Like all that original artwork from the Sega Genesis days, on top of concept work, and then a lot of the scripts and stuff there. And like the Gunstar Hero, before it was called Gunstar Hero, proposal document and that sort of thing is all in there. It's amazing.
Yeah, and even I remember one of the things that I saw was that one of the things, Streets of Rage was originally D-SWAT for yeah, going up against Double Dragon. And side note, I got a repro version of Bare Knuckle 3, and if you've thought of ever picking that up, absolutely do it, because it plays so much better than Streets of Rage 3. It is unbelievable, and it's actually fun to play. I think it is I still think all the Streets of Rage games are all better than all the Final Fight games, but
yep,
check it out, Bare Knuckle 3, and there's a bunch of different sites that do these repros, and it's totally worth, like, I think I paid like $45 for it, and I've just been having a blast because the Streets of Rage 3 for the US is so frustratingly hard,
yeah,
that it's not even, it's not fun to play at all, where this one plays really fast, like, it just feels great, and you actually are able to get through like more than two stages and you don't get juggled, you know, between all the enemies and stuff like that. So it's definitely, search Google, find a repro person and pick that up. And the book, if you want to check out the Mega Drive Genesis book, it's at readonlymemory.vg. And they are shipping worldwide and it comes out to, like I said, like $60, shipped. And this is coming from the UK. So, well worth it. And, something everyone should pick up. It's a great holiday gift too, if you want to do that.
And just one last minute thing too, when yeah, we're talking about Kickstarters, is Ron Gilbert and Gary Winnick just posted their Kickstarter, which is their new adventure game. Have you seen that?
Yes.
I backed it in a heartbeat. It is a return to form to Maniac Mansion, and the art style and everything is exactly like that. It's kind of what everybody's been begging them to do for years, and now they're finally getting the band back together and like, let's just do this. And it looks hilarious. And knowing those two and getting them back together is just going to be worth every penny. And you can get the box version of it, even though it doesn't come with a disc, but it's like a box with a manual.
Yeah, you got to have
that. I think it's at $150. But when you really look at what it is and what you're doing and what you're supporting, it's like I'm almost ready to like up my pledge today to the $150 because that box is going to be awesome.
Yeah, and it's if you want to go to it, it's actually the Kickstarter URL is a little bit long, but it's Thimbleweed Park.
Yeah, search that.
Yeah, if you just want to search for that, and it looks like at the time of recording, they're like $50,000 from their goal, so it looks like they're going to be.
It's only like 28 days left or something like that, right? Like yeah, it's great. It's this early; they're already getting ready to hit their goal. And well, these two guys, they'd be really, like over the last few years, they've been struggling to get people to hear them out on this sort of thing, mm-hmm, and to have them. This is like it kind of takes me back to Broken Age, but like to have them go to Kickstarter and everybody else look at it as the complete no-brainer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm so happy for them, and they're so talented. I can't wait to see what they do with it.
Well, if you, you know, a last question I'll kind of like leave you on, yep, is that, you know, with the way things are today, you can use things like Kickstarter to basically do anything. You can just go, and it's like the ultimate independence where you are, I guess you are just making a promise to the people that are supporting you, but you don't need any kind of publisher. You don't need any kind of outside support except from the direct audience that you're going to be serving. So does that interest you in all as a developer to sometimes, you know, think like, I've had this crazy idea for 20 years and no publisher ever wanted it. Maybe people out there will want it and I can now find out.
It has actually, there's been so many temptations to do it, but you know, you only really get one shot at it.
Yeah.
And I'm not Tim Schafer. I'm not like, you know, I'm not Gary Winnick or Ron Gilbert and these sorts of guys. I mean, I'm doing okay and I'm getting some recognition for stuff. But if I do it, it's got to be the right idea and it's got to be one that's just that no-brainer because there's the two questions everybody has. It's like, is the idea fantastic and I really like it? And then two, can they execute on it and mm-hmm, deliver? And that crosses everybody's minds when they're looking at it. And when people don't know who's actually making the game, that second one, the execution, becomes the bigger question. And we've seen Kickstarters come up, like David Crane with his Pitfall reminiscent Pitfall game that he was trying to get off the ground, and the team he had, they're like, knowing that team, they're fantastic and everything else, but a lot of people didn't know who they were. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the questions during that Kickstarter were like, you know, David Crane's been, he made games a while ago, but what's he doing now? And the reality is he's been making a lot of games lately. And also, but like their perception was so, they were challenged by the idea that old timer David Crane and this other studio they never heard of can make the game that they're talking about. And then the Kickstarter itself had some, you know, flaws in hindsight, now that people have done it a few times, you look back and say, oh yeah, they probably could have done this and that sort of thing. But it's like an example of like, you just got to really have a good story, and you got to really have a good story on the execution side for people to be really excited about. So for me, a lot of things that we've brought up are like, well, could we go to Kickstarter with this? I don't think we've objectively been able to serve both of those issues in these. But then this last week, there's something that kind of came up out of nowhere that I think a lot of people would be very excited about. And then it's something that we would be recognized for. So that suddenly made a lot of sense. And so we're looking at that right now. And then also on top of that, the same thing is that you've got bigger publishers who are basically willing to give you an IP to foster and bring to Kickstarter, just to get it to come back to life, because they might not internally be able to convince everybody to fund it. But if we can bring it to life on Kickstarter, then they will license it. Or they basically will license it to you for pennies on the dollar to get it to happen, as long as you go to their platform and stuff like that. So cool. Things like Sony, when we talk to them, they've got this rich library of stuff that I think a lot of people who listen to this show would be like, it would be amazing to have this. And they're offering that sort of stuff up, which is great.
Yeah, it's a really, really cool environment right now for video games out there to have competition like this, where
yeah,
you can have both companies are selling 10 million consoles in the first year. It's great.
It's amazing. Awesome. I'm really pleased to be, of course, like, this is my livelihood, so it's awesome to see that. But it's really exciting to me that we have gamers who want to support that and that large number. That is phenomenal.
Yeah, and you actually go home and play games. Like, you were, like we were talking yeah. before, you were trying to play Halo early in the week, and you were like, you know, trying to get through some of that stuff. So that's all good stuff. And yeah, of course, you know, as we wrap up, you know, before we do the full wrap up, just of course, thank you to everyone out there that is downloading the show. If you enjoy it, please jump on iTunes and submit a review on there. Also, lots of great stuff going on in the world of video games, and I'll try to post some links for that in the show notes. Like we mentioned, the books that we talked about, unfortunately, the ones in Japan, I don't think you can actually get shipped to the U.S. So hopefully you'll have a friend out there to buy that stuff for you, or, you know, plan a trip while there's still games in Akihabara to buy, because they're kind of all disappearing. And other than that, you can follow us on at Back in My Play. I am at Kevin Larrabee, and of course, Mike is at Mike J. Micah. But yeah, Mike, anything else that, you know, people should keep a heads up for, you know, what's coming up from you guys, or just in general?
Yeah, so we will, of course, it seems like I've been teasing forever on IDAR, but we'll have some news soon. We're going to have a way for people to get the game probably very soon, even though we're going to be coming out a little bit later. So we've got some creative things coming up on that front. And then we have a few other games that we're getting ready to announce pretty soon. But I'm thinking about one of them. I'd like to maybe get back on the show with you and talk about our logic behind it and what we're doing, and kind of like reveal it that way. Would be awesome. And yeah, outside of that, this Christmas is going to be amazing. There's so many great games. Oh, and I really encourage people to go out and try Sunset Overdrive. I was one of the guys who, I thought the sense of humor wasn't really my thing. Mm-hmm. And it still kind of isn't. But the game is so good that I don't care. I kind of saw through some of those flaws, and as you go into it later, it gets a lot better and that sort of thing. But so anybody out there who's been kind of on the fence about it, like, and if it's because you don't like the bombasticness of the story and the character, just like kind of things that are going on, it's so worth it. Just get it. Don't worry about it. And yeah, of course, Master Chief Collection, all these things that are coming out, and Sony's got just so many other things coming out that I'm excited for. It's just the perfect time. And this holiday is just going to be games, games, games.
Yeah, it's been the last two weekends I've literally just sat in my house and played video. Like, I've been the most antisocial person in the world, just because, you know, I'll be streaming on Twitch, so I'll be talking to people on Twitch. That's the cool thing about these consoles. You just, you know, stream on Twitch, talk yeah. to people in the chat. So I'm kind of like socializing with people. But yeah, just echoing what you said, if you own an Xbox One or you're going to buy one, the first game that you should pick up is Sunset Overdrive. It's probably my game of the year at this point. And you know, I was same thing when I saw that initial trailer. I didn't like the character design, but in the first couple minutes of the game, you make your own character. So you make yeah. like the most, you know, crazy over the top character design that you want and dress it up any way that you want. And you can play through Sunset Overdrive like I did as Stone Cold Steve Austin. And it's a blast. And I thought the humor was fantastic. So I will, anytime I can talk about that game and to tell people to buy it, I will. And, yeah. You know, like you said, I mean, with that bundle at $349, I got that white Xbox One bundle, which is like a sweet looking console. So hopefully, Microsoft will throw some more of those out. And, yeah, it's just, like I said, turnaround for Microsoft this last year has been unbelievable. And I can't wait to play some more stuff on that console. But, yeah, that's it. And I promise next time that we have Mike on, what we'll do is we'll also maybe we'll do like a episode where we talk about a game. We'll just think of a game to talk about just because this is fun. But I wanted you to I want the developer to look at a game and to then give me some feedback on it. Or maybe we'll just do some more Neo Geo Pocket Color stuff because that's always good to turn on and hear the great menu music. So yeah, Mike, thank you so much for taking time out of your, I know you're super busy right now, but it's great to talk to you, and we'll definitely have you back on down the road.
Awesome. It's great to be here, and happy holidays to everybody.
Absolutely. Take care.